because we're lining up.
Hey, George.
Hey.
Lining up all of our.
Missed you.
Okay, good morning. We'll get started. Maybe Representative Reardon has some remarks to make, and then I can take over from there.
Well, just as always, very grateful for your being here, your eager participation. Just a side note, I went to a Wine Growers Association presentation yesterday, and they are having issues and discussions very similar to ours, and having more to do with, I believe, herbicides and spray drift and that sort of thing. So I guess they're working with the ODA on some of those issues, and there's, it really sounds so similar. It's like overspray and control of them, and who gets to spray what, and all of this stuff. So we're not alone, and I'm sure the ODA is well entertained by all of this. And it's not, I don't think it's too early to start thinking about recommended actions. It's we have one more meeting after this, and then we're supposed to have a report, a draft report, in toward the end of September. Could you talk about that, just that process, just
sure,
a little bit, Beth?
Sure. So here's what I've been thinking, and I'm really open and interested in your input on this process, because as Representative Reardon mentions, the report is technically due October 1st. We have one more meeting 2 weeks from now in August, and then a final meeting scheduled right now at the end of September. My thought was to structure the report based on the tasks that are laid out in the legislation. So the same way we've been kind of working through the topics in these meetings, structure the report the same way, ask that the members of the group that have worked on different pieces of that report work with me to develop, under each topic, a summary of the types of materials and information that the group has received and discussed, and then also a set of recommendations, to the extent there are some under each task, listed out by task, and then allow the group an opportunity to review those recommendations, add to them, disagree with them, you know, give input on those recommendations, and then bring the report back, the full report, once all the pieces get done, back to the full group to have a discussion and to talk about the recommendations. On the recommendations themselves, there are a couple options. One is the report can include consensus recommendations of the group. It can include both consensus recommendations and other recommendations that some of the task force members are supportive of. You can make the list of recommendations what you would like for it to be. And so I'm interested in your input on that, and sort of if that process sounds like something that will work. It's something that's been used by other task forces and has been successful. So it's an iterative back and forth between me and members of the task force, and then bringing everything back together to the whole group at the end. Any thoughts, feedback? Okay.
Sounds good.
Sounds reasonable.
You know, when you see comments from, when you see regulatory proposals, and they frequently they include the comments from people that dissented or wrote uh-huh. in, as well as what their recommendations
sure.
are, and it might
yeah.
be worth including that so that it's kind of out there all in the beginning when people start reading it.
That's perfectly fine. I think that's reasonable. And it would be a much better, I think, more complete report if that's what you'd like to do.
I'm sorry, I drifted off here.
Frequently when you see like regulatory proposals, and then associations or commenters write in, and you get the final regulation, the agency will put what the regulation is, but also they'll put underneath it, these were the things that this association didn't like about it, and here's why. They'll put a series of sort of dissenting remarks.
Okay.
Yeah. Like the Supreme Court.
I was listening to the radio driving down the road the other day, and I was surprised to hear that this task force, according to OPB and quoting an article in the Statesman, that this task force is recommending that beekeepers be compensated up to $20,000 for losses. And I was wondering if there's any way.
Congratulations.
If there was any way we could.
Get your money down.
No, I'm saying that I don't know where the source of that was. Apparently, they were they were quoting something in the Statesman Journal, but I'm, do we have any control over that? Whether the source was sitting right behind you at the last meeting. The reporter was sitting there. I don't. So I was just wondering if there was a transcript of the discussion that could be available so that there would be less misunderstanding.
I am working on pretty comprehensive meeting notes. So we will have that. It's not going to be immediate, but I think that that will help in terms of really framing the discussion, what actually was discussed. I mean, my assumption is that the interaction you had with the
Dr. Spivak.
Yeah, that's where that came from, obviously, but I don't.
Right.
Yeah. The group didn't talk about a recommendation, so.
Yeah. Just one thing that I might suggest is, however the report, I think what you're doing is the right kind of approach. Having all the materials that the task force had as an addendum, just so everybody can see the kind of information that we saw. My suggestion, in order for help for the next step when the legislature is going to be looking at this, is that have an executive summary where we list areas where there may be consensus, and then on other issues where there may not be consensus, to list that there's a variety of views on mm-hmm. these different topics. Mm-hmm. Then they can go hunt for those if those are really of the biggest mm-hmm. import to them. But my sense is I'd rather have some clarity, if there's any to be derived from this task force, in an executive summary, so the legislator who has 4 minutes to read this before he goes into a meeting, he or she has at least a chance to look at that.
And as far as the press goes, I mean, generally speaking, if you contact a reporter and ask for a correction, they'll make it. And you don't have to generally prove it if you're a credible source. So I've asked people to correct everything from my neighborhood association, National Night Out, had the wrong date published, and they fixed it online in 20 seconds after I sent an email to something pretty complicated.
Honestly, I didn't go back to the original article, and I have no idea where the miscommunication was, so I don't have any idea. But I was just wondering if we could provide better written transcript or something that might help, but maybe that's just too much work.
Well, it sounds like we will have not a verbatim transcript, but something closer to that, just not yet. And I just got a note from somebody that said they read the Statesman article, and it was pretty clear in the article that it was Minnesota that was compensating, not that you were recommending. So, yeah, I don't know. It must have been in the translation between the two news groups.
Okay.
As far as for the report and the rest of the meetings, you know, both with education outreach and then today regulation licensing, there's been a lot explored, and we're looking at other states and international, but there's more out there than just what they've done. And I'm curious, I mean, on both of those fronts, I have ideas. They might not be any good, but we haven't even vetted them.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we do that? I don't want to just limit ourselves to what has someone else done when we might have other ideas here.
Well, I think that's what the recommendations are. I mean, I don't think it's based on simply the information you've received from the other areas, but that may be the basis for a recommendation for Oregon, but the recommendations should be for what Oregon should do.
So in the meeting, where is that in the process so that it can be?
Well, part of it will be in the process of writing the report. So you'll have an opportunity, both in the areas that you've brought information forward and in the other areas, to make recommendations and to include those into the report. And then the group can discuss what those recommendations are at the meeting, definitely on the 29th of September. And if that isn't sufficient time, I've also just spoken with Representative Reardon about the possibility of an additional meeting in October if that's necessary. So you will have some time to discuss the recommendations.
So we're going to talk education and outreach another time to bring up new ideas? I just don't understand when, because I can't give a recommendation if we haven't talked about it as a group. I'm sorry, I might just need to ask, and please forgive me if I am.
Yeah, you may need an additional meeting.
Maybe, that's what at the last meeting I was suggesting, if we have summary of each of those so that we don't forget what we discussed previous week. So maybe we can have summaries for all these meetings, and maybe we have another extra meeting. As you said, we can have another extra session where we can just go through each of those again and see these are the points that we really wanted to be as recommendations or something.
So my point is that there's things that at last meeting or possibly this meeting we're not going to get to. Like things that, so do we want the pesticide program, or excuse me, the pesticide stewardship partnership program to be doing more research into neonicotinoids? I don't know, but we haven't talked about it because it didn't happen in Minnesota or New Jersey. And so how do we, that's my question. How do we get to those other things that are part of the conversation?
I mean, I think time is obviously an issue here.
Right.
So if you have recommendations on how to address those other things that aren't being brought in, well, for two things. If you know about them, I would definitely bring them up during the discussion at the meeting so that can be part of the record of what the group has talked about. But there's just so, well, there's so much that it is hard to limit and to know how to get everything into the discussion. So
if I send it via email to the group to talk about is what I was thinking, mm-hmm. and even if it's not, and so that it's visible to folks so they can bring it up as well, because...
My only concern there is that it not become a discussion, an email discussion, but that if it's to bring topics here to the group, I think that's great. I just think that the discussion should happen here. And then in the drafting of the report, there'll be back and forth, I think, between the members of the group as well, and a discussion in the full group.
So is your concern that there's, I'm looking at the work plan, that there's a topic that needs to be covered that's not on the work plan?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think we cover, I like the topics, best management practices, education, outreach, regulation, those all make sense, but we frame them around what are other people doing, and we haven't talked about what other ideas are out there. And I don't want to recreate a wheel, but there might be something else that's worth looking at.
Or you want something like each session, can we have like 15 minutes on things that are not there in this thing? Or?
Well, does anyone, I'm going to... What do other people think? I mean, am I alone in this, or what?
No, I completely understand what you're saying. We've been kind of taking a look at what's out there and learning and information gathering, but haven't provided any unique ideas. So I think there definitely needs to be a time for that at some point on the work plan where we're able to vet some of those ideas and have discussions about them. Obviously, from my perspective, it would be helpful if you've got some of those ideas to get them to us ahead of time, and then we can kind of think about them, and then our time can be a little bit more constructive instead of having to spend a lot of time going through exactly what the ideas are. But I think that's an important component, mm-hmm. definitely.
Okay. I think maybe the way that it, going back in time, we should have just added another question to the work plan for each meeting, which was just other ideas, ?
Right.
So I don't know if we can do that from now on, just have that sort of other ideas question, so that way we can present unique thoughts and not feel limited. And I would think that probably other people were feeling relatively comfortable going ahead and saying things that were a little outside the box, but because I think we did talk about some of that stuff last week, but to make sure that people don't feel like they're breaking the rules while they're doing that.
If we're having similar feelings, could I... I know we had some information about the education outreach, but I've never felt like we've had a chance to talk about it either. So I reached out to a communications company. I'll be talking more with them next week about our issues that we've discussed. If I get something out of that, I want to share it with this group and see what you think. So we haven't had time to really brainstorm and react. Does that under the heading of, I'm looking at the end here, we have recommended actions. Would it be reasonable to start submitting recommended actions so that we can start getting those? Or is that too, do we need more discussion before you can make a recommended action?
That's a whole other question. Oh, no.
I think we could all talk forever on this stuff. But
my, I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't see.
My recommendation is you make a list of different things that you want to talk about, put them in a parking lot, then we can go through them. I don't want people to feel like the ship passed them by and they didn't have a chance to articulate themselves. Because I think that if you go one by one, it becomes a little more protracted. Otherwise, you can organize certain items and really kind of go through and see what if there's a through line on a recommendation. That way also, it will help folks if Christy and I should disagree on an issue, I want to make sure that if her perspective is on the prevailing side, that I then make a note that I have the freedom to pose a different point of view, even though it's not the recommendation of the group. So I just think that save yourself some heartache by making a list, putting them over on a right-hand column, and then organize it, so then it will give us purpose and ability to go through it.
Or even better than being on the negative side, maybe come into that middle ground between the two.
Well, I'm not saying that you don't seek consensus. I'm just saying that if it was something that we just fundamentally, Christy and I can't see eye to eye on, I just use it because she's sitting next to me.
We might disagree too.
Might be fun. But I just want to make sure that either side has the, well, we both have the opportunity to articulate it.
So the one observation I have is, in your presentation, you made it clear that the consensus in the scientific community is that pollinator declines are multifaceted, and that there are three, for honeybees, there are three parts. And our discussion has almost all been on regulations and on only one of those parts. And so this probably all started because of some incidences with pesticide use, but there may be some recommendations we could make to the legislature that had to do with the other two parts of the recognized area of pollinator decline. And I can think of a couple of them that I don't think would be that difficult and we'd have good consensus on, and that the legislature might embrace. So that's, I don't know when you want to have that discussion, but I think that's important. If we, if we're not a pesticide task force, if we're a honeybee health task force, then I think we need to at least do that. Now, having said that, last week it was really clear that there are a lot of people doing a lot of things already, and there's no sense in recreating any of that stuff or competing with it or anything. But I think there are some opportunities here that would provide some balance.
I think, George, in the next meeting we'll be talking some of those where it says research needs, and there are some questions like how does Oregon gather pollination, population data, and those kind of things. I think we can fit in those kind of things at that meeting, I would say. Yeah, you can bring like B4H and those kind of things probably.
Yeah, I think that there's some issues on that with public right-of-ways and land use in parks and public lands and so forth, that we could make recommendations to the legislature that I think would be accepted and could have a dramatic impact on this issue.
It's a really good reminder.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So, yeah, I really appreciate all the homework that you guys have been doing for the past 2 weeks. Yeah, I'll take Rich's question and then we'll...
Just want to add a little bit more to what everybody else is saying, basically second it. Because Beth was mentioned about not wanting a parking lot discussion, but you know the simple reality is we got 6 more hours.
Yeah.
We don't have time to discuss all these things. I like the idea of I want to hear everybody's views, especially if they're different from me, because I need to understand why.
Yeah.
And I think one of the ways we can handle that is what I'm about to do is, here's my ideas. You just mentioned right away. That's a big thing on my list, too. But I don't know if anybody else is thinking of it. So I like the idea of I'm about to send out an email to you. See, these are some of my ideas. What do you think? Because we have to have some discussion outside this.
We can't. We can't have an email discussion, right?
I mean, sharing of ideas.
Sharing of ideas is fine. And so here's one option. At the next meeting, I can bring to you, prior to the next meeting, an example of what I'm talking about preparing for the report, so that you can see on a topic, the topic that we went over last week is probably what I'm going to use, what it would look like and what would be the basis of a group discussion for that topic. And then we can even spend time at the next meeting trying that and seeing what it would be like to go through the outreach section, public education section, and have the group have that discussion. And then see if you feel like that's sufficient, if that's going to be an opportunity that you want to share your ideas and discuss them and develop the recommendations from the group.
That sounds great to
try
me.
That and I see. Okay, let's try that. And like we said, you know, it may be that the September 29th meeting is an opportunity to discuss funding options, which is the one topic for that that's left at that point, and then to go over in a pretty intense way the other areas that you've discussed and the initial list of recommendations for the other areas, and then to schedule an additional meeting in October to kind of wrap it up rather than trying to do that. It's on September 29th.
I don't understand how we can just violate the due date. We can just violate the due date.
And it happens.
Okay. That's fine.
I was thinking we'd write some like really several reports and then
that's often what happens. It's just sort of a preliminary, more to come date sort of thing. So
cut your pay.
Okay. And we'll make some sort of arrangement for some me to be replaced or something, or how will that work?
Oh,
I guess we could talk about that offline since it's just me. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's just important that we not just like let the position representing the environmental community go and not have that position represented. Thanks, Jeff. I'm sure you could.
Yeah, we'll definitely address that.
We'll cover for you, Kristen.
Jeff and I will split your face.
Okay, then we'll start today's session. So the topic is pesticide regulation. So we have two speakers today. I have Dr. Jeff Jenkins. He's a professor in environmental and molecular toxicology at Oregon State University, and he's also a PI with the NPIC, the National Pesticide Information Center, and he has extensive experience both international and national dealing with pesticide issues, and probably he'll talk a little bit about that as well. So I know we are already running late with this session, so I'll start with Dr. Jeff Jenkins.
Thank you, Ramesh. I'm running sideways.
Yeah, you can sit as well if you feel that comfortable or you want to stand. It's up to you.
I'll try.
Grab the professor.
I'll start out sitting down. If I get excited, I'll stand up.
Well, no, that's an important point.
It was my understanding that today, at least in this part that I'm involved with, that your interest is in pesticide regulation with a focus on pollinators. And my title says risk assessment, but risk assessment is a huge part of the regulation process. And what I plan to do is skim over the surface of what's called ecological risk assessment at EPA, and how EPA relates to the states and how EPA relates to harmonization of pesticide regulation around the world. And in particular in the developed countries, which is primarily Europe, but also Australia, Brazil to a certain extent, Japan, India to a certain extent. So with that, I can go as fast or slow as you want. I'm going to try to gauge how much detail I should give you, but I'm going to start out by just kind of skimming over the top of these issues, and you can stop me and say we want to go on to something else. You can stop me and say let's talk a little bit more about this, and we'll just see how it goes. So EPA pesticide risk assessment and management is under something called the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. It was amended in 96 by something called the Food Quality Protection Act. It's a quasi-risk benefit statute. It determines risk to human health and the environment. And when you say environment, that's everything other than humans. So they kind of divide it up into two ways of doing risk assessments, humans and then everyone else. You look at toxicity to humans and wildlife. You look at opportunities for exposure. And we'll talk a little in a little bit more detail about the registration process, how you decide if a pesticide is going to be registered and for what uses. And then there's something called the re-registration process, which I think all of us feel that from time to time EPA ought to go back and re-look at chemistries based on new data and make new decisions about how those products are registered. And so when this is done, often through the re-registration process, risks are new concerns are mitigated with label restrictions or mandates. And that's kind of where the pollinator issue is probably going to fall, at least in part, is with changes to the labels on the products. The other kind of overarching issue is that products that are registered in Oregon are registered for the entire state. And they're not generally site-specific. How they're used on a site-by-site basis is up to the applicator. And how we get at this process we're going to talk about, I'll talk about in a little more detail. So real simple, this is risk assessment in a real simple framework. You've got pesticide use practices. You've got human wildlife susceptibility and behavior. And when use practices overlap with either wildlife or humans, in the middle there's this risk assessment process. And pesticide use practices result in opportunities for pesticide exposure, and that's part of the risk assessment process. So this is from EPA, what they do. And now I'm already up.
Now he's excited.
So this is the risk assessment process. Why is something hazardous, in this case hazardous to bees? How much does it take to cause harm? What are the exposure pathways? And then you kind of put that into a package. They call it risk characterization. This is what the scientists do. This is the policy people over here, the risk managers. They take the risk characterization. They look for control options, mitigation potentially, measures on labels, and they make decisions, legal considerations, and all the other social, political, and economic considerations go into a decision on the management side. So science here, policy management here, and an interface.
I can tell you're going to be up to date, right?
So as far as how this interfaces with the states, you've got EPA looking at the potential risks and creating and doing a risk assessment, creating a label with this risk management component, and it also contains, all labels contain risk mitigation measures. And then that filters down into something called, so cost-effective requirements to ensure safe use, a clear understanding of label restrictions and use mandates, and then finally informed decision-making at the front line of pesticide use. So it ends up with the pesticide user. And so this entire process, and you need all elements of this, this is the backbone of how pesticides are regulated in the U.S., in Europe, but it comes down to that person making the application. And are they doing on a site-specific basis, are they doing the right thing? Are they considering what are my production goals and what are my environmental protection goals, and am I meeting both of those goals? And so this is primarily as someone who works for Extension, this is primarily where I interface. I'm working along this continuum with those that are applying chemicals and those who are concerned about application of chemicals, and we're trying to get to this safe and beneficial use outcome. So, how are pesticides regulated by EPA? Well, there's something called 40 CFR 158. That's the rulemaking. There are data requirements, and that results in test guidelines. These guidelines are harmonized with Europe and the other developing world. So we've got Office of Pesticide Program, Office of Pesticide Program Toxic Substances, and then the OECD in Europe. The guidelines are harmonized across the developing world. And both are constantly under review and frequently updated. And you know that pollinators right now is way up there on the radar screen for this harmonization process of testing guidelines.
Are you allowed to interrupt with questions?
Sure.
Why do you think that there's like disagreement then using the same test but then disagreement about, so they have the same test guidelines but then different results?
Well,
that goes back to that other, that, we can back up a little bit. That goes to this.
Okay.
Here's the scientists, risk assessors. They characterize the risk, and then it goes to the policy people. Different policy outcomes.
Right.
The social, political, economic context. Is the social, political, economic context different in Europe or Japan or Australia than the U.S.? Yes. Different outcomes. Same data, different outcomes. So there's something called pesticide re-registration. So we've got all these products that were originally registered quite a while ago, but they're constantly being re-reviewed, and this is the re-registration process. Review supporting scientific studies, update human health and ecological risk assessments using current science. That may result in either to cancel or re-register the uses and to develop risk mitigation measures, new label language. And so in a generic sense, this is what's going on now with regards to pollinators.
So where does conditional registration fit in this?
That's an interim process while this is going on. So they may conditionally register something while this re-registration process is still in process.
Original registrations are sometimes conditional, aren't they?
Yes. Where's Rose? What, do you want to say something, Rose?
Yes, it's probably a point of contention for a lot of people that a product is registered and it's contingent on additional data being submitted to EPA, but that there's not really or hasn't been historically a good mechanism to keep track of what data are due to EPA. And so I think they're really trying to firm up that particular situation.
Can you characterize the kinds of things that are usually not there? Is it everything, or is it just mostly field data? Or?
So there's almost always data types. And then the agency has to make a decision: are we going to allow this product to be used conditionally while we fill these data gaps, or are we going to pull it off the market? And so that's a decision that's made by the agency, and it really falls under this last statement here. Re-register a pesticide if it can be used without unreasonable adverse effects to human health or the environment. Now, this is language. This is a paraphrasing of the language out of the enabling legislation, FIFRA. The person that makes this decision within EPA is the head of EPA. So this is an administrative decision, not a scientific decision. This is not made by the scientists. If you want to challenge an EPA decision, you have to go through the Administrative Procedures Act, and it goes all the way to the top of EPA. And this is basically all they're held to do, this one sentence. Can it be used without unreasonable adverse effects to human health or the environment? And this obviously applies to pollinators, and this one sentence is what's driving the risk assessment process for pollinators at the federal level. It trickles down to the states too, and it's also harmonized with Europe and the rest of the developing world.
Yeah. So, fourth small bullet says develop risk mitigation measures, new label language. Is there any other communications about proper use other than labels?
So, this informed decision making process can be robust. Not just the label, and states take it upon themselves at the Department of Ag level or other lead agency level, and Cooperative Extension takes it on theirself to expand upon not just the label language, but getting the message out in a useful way.
But as far as the manufacturer is concerned, they have to put a label on it, and that's. Is that it?
The label's the law, and the label has the mitigation measures on it. It's a legal document with the required mitigation measures.
Okay. Thank you.
So what's going on right now with registration, and this is to kind of put the pollinator issue in context with everything else that EPA is doing, approximately 1,150 pesticide active ingredients organized into 613 cases. They completed this in what they call a re-registration eligibility decision. And this is the overall risk to human health and the environment, including pollinators. It took them about 20 years to complete this. The Food Quality Protection Act of 1996 required EPA to assess within 10 years 9,721 existing tolerances. This is the pesticides that are allowed in food. And that's been completed, and the tolerances must meet a new standard. Reasonable certainty of no harm, safety standard. Now, there's some interest within EPA in applying this standard that came out of the Food Quality Protection Act, across the board. So this is emerging. So now we got another piece of legislation, the Food Quality Protection Act, that adds this other language that an administrator may be held to under the Administrative Procedures Act. Is there a reasonable certainty of no harm? Now, the Food Quality Protection Act only applies that to human health and food safety, but the agency is thinking about how they might apply this across the board. So now that they've gone through this process, the current goal is to reevaluate each registered pesticide at least every 15 years. So this is an ongoing process. And this pollinator issue is falling into this current goal down here, the 15-year cycle for each product. The data that's used, studies accepted by US EPA for pesticide registration or registration purposes must comply with good laboratory practices. 40 CFR Part 160. So a lot of discussion about all of this data out in the literature and why isn't it being used by EPA to do risk assessments. It's there, data other than data submitted to them by the registrants that's been conducted under good laboratory practices, they're at their discretion to use other data. And they use this good laboratory practices yardstick to decide whether the data is appropriate for risk assessment or not. Yes.
So, is it possible to have data from another country that would meet GLPs and it would be accepted? Or
the European Union has their own version of GLPs. They have the same in using this kind of harmonized approach. It doesn't mean that EPA does not consider all data that's out in the literature. They do. But oftentimes they may not use data that's out in the literature for risk assessments because it doesn't meet. First of all of the studies that EPA requires were specifically designed for the risk assessment process. All of the data that's out in the literature the studies weren't done to meet some risk assessment objective, and they may not meet good laboratory practice criteria. And that creates a rub, because someone in the environmental community says, here's all this great data out here, you're not using it in your risk assessment. And that creates concerns.
But country of origin doesn't necessarily mean because it could still meet GLPs.
Yes. And so this is at the discretion of the scientists that are doing the risk assessment process within EPA, what studies they use. GLP regulations describe the minimal standards for conducting laboratory and field studies that support or are intended to support pesticide registration or re-registration. EPA also considers information in the open literature as part of the registration or re-registration process. Greater weight is given to those studies that were specifically designed to be used in risk assessments and those conducted under GLPs. This is a huge bone of contention right now. A lot of literature out there on how pesticides might harm honeybees, published literature, that may or may not be considered by EPA or the EU for the risk assessment process. So what is ecological risk assessment? Evaluates risk to wildlife, aquatic organisms, plant, including federally threatened and endangered species. It's based on peer-reviewed methods, best available data. This is kind of an outline of that process. I'm not going to go through all this. I'm just trying to give you an idea of kind of the structure and the complexity of the ecological risk assessment process. So there's a problem formulation, source and exposure characteristic phase. And I'm not going to go through all of this in any detail, but I just want to give you a sense of how EPA walks through this ecological risk assessment process, and this also applies to honeybees. So they look at the potential, where it's going to be used, typical maximum, typical use rates, minimum available to application intervals, what application methods are used. They look at exposure information, how does it degrade and move in the environment, And there are required tests for all of these bullets that the registrar must supply data to the agency for all in all of these areas. They use the open literature to look at PhysChem properties, degradation, fate and transport, et cetera, and monitoring data. They consider both acute and chronic effects, although most of the emphasis is on acute effects, and that's a bone of contention right now by folks outside of the regulation process. Why isn't there more studies required on chronic effects as opposed to acute effects? It's divided into terrestrial wildlife and aquatic wildlife. Into these general categories. And then here's some of the testing guidelines for birds, mammals, freshwater fish, invertebrates, marine fish, estuarine marine invertebrates, aquatic and terrestrial plants, and terrestrial insects. And then you can see honeybee acute contact is one of those. And then here are the test studies that are required. Here's the endpoints, et cetera, just to give you an idea of the kind of data that's required. The assessment endpoints, what's the receptor, what attribute or characterization that is important to protect and is potentially at risk, what's the ecological relevance, susceptible to potential stressor like pesticide, and what are the management goals. So they do a critical review of the exposure and effects data. And they look at tox endpoints, they use exposure modeling and monitoring data. Something called T-REX is the terrestrial residue exposure model that's used to estimate potential exposures to terrestrial animals. This doesn't include honeybees generally. Honeybees are evaluated separately. And they look at estimates of pesticide residues on wildlife food items, adjusted by application rate, et cetera. They use incident data. So EPA collects incident data on honeybees right now. That's a huge emphasis of collecting that kind of data. That's used in the risk assessments. And so then you go into that characterization phase. You take the data on exposure, on what's the hazard and the dose response. And so control studies using surrogate species. So EPA, to assess the effects on all wildlife, only studies a few species, and then that's extrapolated to all wildlife. Some concern about that. Birds are used to extrapolate to amphibians. Does that seem appropriate? Folks outside of the agency have concerns because of amphibian decline, whether they shouldn't have an amphibian test rather than using birds to extrapolate to amphibians. So the risk characterization is to integrate the effects of exposure, integrate the adverse effects and exposure characterization to an overall conclusion. That's the risk estimation. A lot of times they use something called a risk quotient. How much are they exposed to divided by the toxicity? And then that's compared to a level of concern. So there's some bright line. We don't think honeybees should be exposed to any more than this amount of this chemical. And what's our estimate of exposure based on our level of concern? And so you also, in the risk characterization, need to describe all the assumptions you used, all the limitations, and all the uncertainties. So you need to characterize what you know and what you don't know in the risk assessment. And this is very important. And then you also need to determine, is the characterization complete? This is that data gap thing. And a lot of times the risk characterization is say, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, here's the data gaps that we think need to be filled in to provide a complete characterization. And so then this goes to the risk managers. And so the risk characterization is to put everything in context, information on where the pesticide is used, what are the local practices, what are the biological requirements and habitat of the species? What are the geographic features that influence exposure? What do we know about incidents? And what sort of information do we have on monitoring? And then these are the surrogate species that are used. I'm not going to go into detail, but there is this surrogacy approach that you should be aware of. And then, as far as uncertainty goes, are the surrogate species reasonable representatives? Do mortality, reproduction, and growth represent a reasonable range of effects to which to gauge ecological impacts? We know for pollinators that the concern right now goes way beyond mortality, reproduction, and growth. There's lots of other what they call sublethal influence that are of concern with regards to effects on pollinators. And can the laboratory effects be readily extrapolated to the field? This is also a huge issue right now with pollinators. Understanding actual exposure, patterns of exposure in the field, et cetera, for pollinators. Toxicity studies are typically conducted on the technical grade active ingredient. Formulated end products may be more or less toxic to the technical active grade. So there's also concern that the formulation needs to be tested more broadly. And this concept of mixtures is also on the radar screen of concern to the agency, but it says methods under development. So what about pesticide risk to honeybees? And so we know that in general insecticides are more toxic to honeybees than fungicides or herbicides. Most poisonings occur when insecticides are applied during the bloom. Exposure pathways include drift, contamination of flowering, ground cover plants, pesticide residues on pollen and nectar. You've heard about this by foraging pollinators. Pollinators drinking or touching contaminated water, dew or putation water, and exposure to dust from seed treatments. So this is kind of the landscape now for EPA moving forward on their risk assessment of pollinators. What are they doing right now? EPA evaluates pesticide outdoor uses for toxicity to pollinators. So all the outdoor uses, not indoor, but outdoor uses are evaluated for toxicity to pollinators. They have something that's called a tier one test. It's the acute contact lethal dose to half the test population, the LD50. And then based on the LD50 value, and unlike all other ecological tests that EPA conducts, pollinators are a special case. They physically apply the chemical to the honeybees. They've got an apparatus that drops the chemical directly onto the bee to do these assays. So it's a worst case scenario. It's very conservative. Toxicity category one, highly toxic to bees. This is what goes on the label. If the LD50 is less than or greater than 2 micrograms per bee, toxicity category two, toxic to bees. If the LD50 is greater than 2 but less than 11 micrograms per bee, toxicity category 3, no bee caution on the label if it's greater than 11 micrograms per bee. So they physically do this test, they drop the chemical onto the bee. If the LD50, the amount that it takes to kill half the test population, is greater than 11 micrograms per bee, there's no precautionary language on the label. Residual toxicity, how long following application the pesticide is toxic to bees, that's something they also look at. Pesticides that last longer in the environment are going to have a longer residual activity. Yes.
Just quickly, I've known Jeff for 20 years, but I disagree on the fact that lethality dose is worst case. And one of the points.
I'm not saying that.
Well, you said it's conservative.
I'm saying that how you test acute toxicity, this is a worst case.
Right. Well,
not that lethality is a risk.
Well, and it is a lethality test.
Yes.
I guess the issue is that this is the first tier. Do we need to go further, or is this a problem or not? First question. And there is other. There's, like you said, sublethal. Yeah.
So
it's okay.
My purpose right now is not to tell you what I think about this.
It's how
my
it's
purpose
about
right
this.
Now is to inform you of what EPA is doing.
Right. You just said it was conservative, and I don't see that a 50% death rate is conservative. It's okay. It's a different view.
I'm not sure.
I know in principle that it's not a...
The category three is, could you explain that again, please?
Category three is there is no bee caution on the label if the LD50 this is the lethal dose to 50% of the population. When they do the study in the lab and they drop the chemicals onto the bees, this microgram per bee is greater than 11 micrograms per bee.
Okay, thank you.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But you also need to look at the residual. This is also of concern to the agency. One of the concerns about the neonics is that they may be very, very long-lived. And so this residual activity needs to be taken into account. Malathion's toxic to bees, but under a lot of circumstances, it's gone in a day. So you have to take the residual activity into account along with the acute toxicity. So then they have a tier two called field testing for pollinators may be required if the above tests indicate adverse effects on bees. So you look at this initial screening tier one test with acute toxicity, then based on the findings of that, you may go out and do a field test. Toxicity categories one and two are called bee toxic pesticides, and the product label will have specific use instructions to reduce risk to pollinators. This is the mitigation language that goes on the label as a part of the risk management process. Bee toxic pesticides with extended residual activity may require additional mitigation measures or application restrictions to protect pollinators. And so there is a debate out there now. The neonics are applied in a number of different ways. I think that there really needs to be a lot of We need to look closer at this residual toxicity issue with the neonics in particular. So, this recently came out of a publication down here published in 2014, looking at how are bees exposed and what sorts of exposure pathways should we consider? Pesticides, seeds, surface water, soil, plants, from the seeds you have abraded dust. All of these may interact with the foraging worker. Enters the hive, then you've got royal jelly, brood, wax, propolis, interaction with the queen, pollinator diversity. You can see that this is kind of a blow up of that exposure pathway that's now being considered by EPA and how they do their risk assessments for pollinators. Two publications recently came out. The first one was submitted by the FIFRA Scientific Advisory Panel for review and comment. So Office of Pesticide Programs, which administers the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, has a scientific advisory panel that meets with the agency on a regular basis. These are scientists outside of the agency. The agency presents information to them about the regulatory process, and in this case, the regulation of labels with respect to pollinators, and the advisory panel produces a report. This is a white paper in support of proposed risk assessment process for bees. And so EPA has a proposal out there for how they are going to, in the future, do pollinator risk assessment. This was done in connection with Health Canada and California Department of Pesticide Regulation. So this is a joint white paper between California, Canada, and the US. And this is, so EPA presented this proposal to them, and then it was evaluated by the scientific advisory panel. That's one of the documents that I supplied. And in 2013, kind of piggybacked on this document, guidance on risk assessment of plant protection products on bees, the European Food Safety Authority. This is the complementary organization to OPP in Europe. Even though it says Food Safety Authority, they also cover eco-risk. This is their document, which somewhat mirrors the white paper. These are long, involved, you'll be bored to tears, documents on all of the gory details of how they propose to revise the risk assessment process for pollinators. So there's something on the horizon, something that this group might want to consider that may be contained in these documents. I'm not sure. This might be something for further discussion. So a little bit about the about the neonicotinoids in general and where the concern lies. Here's kind of the road here's kind of the roadmap for the neonics worldwide, which ones they are, who makes them, some of the product names, just gives you kind of the scale of this particular class of chemicals. What's the concerns about neonics? And a lot of this is coming from outside of the current registration process. While acute lethal effects are of concern, the major concern is for sublethal and chronic effects on fitness and survival. So outside of the agency, this is what the environmental community and other scientists are concerned about. These outcomes that may not be adequately addressed by the current risk assessment methods. Sublethal effects include disorientation and difficulty returning back to the hive. This is his homing ability, reduced foraging and travel, impaired memory and learning, failure to communicate properly with nestmates. Feeding, communication, reproduction, hygiene, immune response of social insects are very complex. Study results can be confused with a wide variety of biological and geographic factors affecting treated colonies and the untreated controls. These are just concerns about the current research. Discrepancy between clear lab results and inconclusive or negative field results. We've got a real issue with the possibility of the neonics being harmful to honeybees based on lab results, and the probability of them being harmful based on field results. There's a discrepancy there between those. Neonics are toxic to bees, but are they causing harm in the field? It's inconclusive. Few lab studies conducted at environmentally relevant pesticide levels and patterns of exposure. Field study levels and patterns of exposure are not well understood and or confounded with other stressors like disease or parasites. There's this issue of floral resources, the starvation issue, what levels of pesticide residues are in the pollen and nectar. Huge debate over that now. There's some data on pesticide levels in pollen and nectar, but what do we know on a species-by-species basis based on current use patterns? Do the hives display similar levels of disease and parasites, which can affect hive health? So we've got this overlapping stressor when field studies are done. And is there considerable mortality or abnormal behavior observed in control hives based on other stressors? So, in conclusion, uncertainty in ecological risk assessment is uniquely large to other science-based policy areas. So this is one of the real drivers with the debate over pollinators. There's just not enough information, not enough knowledge. And so with too much uncertainty comes the ability to stake out widely different policy areas around the issue. So we need to reduce the uncertainty. This is something that as a scientist I'm very interested in. How can we shrink that playing field, the policy playing field down by reducing the uncertainty? So the distance between opinions is narrower. USDA EPA have identified pollinator risks to include pesticide, parasites, and poor forage. This is just kind of the easy to remember short list. There's a longer list. Current understanding of the risk to pollinators associated with pesticide use is inadequate, and resources should be allocated to a better understanding of pesticide patterns of use, highly controversial area around the country, Oregon included. Pesticide distribution and fate at a scale relevant to pollinator exposure. include the bioavailability of systemic pesticides. Huge concern about neonics when they're used as a soil drench. They go up into the tree, and now all the emphasis is on how much of that is getting to somewhere in that plant that honeybees could be exposed to it. And there's just not enough known about how much is on the inside versus how much is on the outside and what the true exposure patterns are. Pollinator occurrence and behavior, that determines exposure. This is the field studies. And pesticide adverse effects on pollinator fitness and survival. And this is, I think, what you're getting at, not just the acute studies, but all of the potential impacts on pollinators that affect fitness and survival. So I'll stop there.
So I'm assuming that the risk assessment would include the volume of a material that's available in the environment, its volume of use. That I think there's something called a risk cup, and there's a determination of how much of this we can stand to have in total. Yeah. So I'm just, my question is, how do we know how much of these materials are finding their way into use? And from our discussions, it sounded like you're not keeping track of that in Oregon, and from your comment, we don't know how many home users, how many tons are used by home users, what the sales data are, stuff. I'm just wondering, how does EPA know how much of these, any particular material is actually being used? How's that data collected?
So EPA, within Office of Pesticide Programs, they have a division, BEED, Biological Economic Effects Division, something like that. That the BEED group within OPP prepares a report in this re-registration process on patterns of use and extent of use nationally to be used as part of the risk assessment process. It's funny you mentioned the risk cup. That's a term that came out of food safety, not out of ecological risk, but I'm going to be at a meeting next week in San Francisco. The International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry is putting on their International Congress of Pesticide Chemistry next week in San Francisco. So folks from all over the world are coming into San Francisco to talk about all pesticide-related issues.
So,
but May Birdbaum, who's the chair of the entomology department at the University of Illinois and one of the leaders in the pollinator area now as a scientist, is giving a presentation relating pollinator health to the risk cup. So it's funny that you brought that up.
But I'm still confused.
Should you explain the risk
cup? There's a group,
right,
at EPA or that determines how much of this stuff is being used. I'm just wondering if you know, how do they, if it's not being collected here and or there, how do they know? I mean, extrapolating? What is it?
I think we all know that there's one state that collects that kind of data, that's California. And New York State collects a limited amount of use data, and the rest of the states don't really collect use data, or it's not required. The industry, there's a group called DONES that the industry is probably used to. DONES is a private organization that tracks sales of pesticides, and for a lot of money, we'll provide you with sales information. There's a couple of organizations like DOMES, but Office of Pesticide Programs uses that commercially available sales data as one of their primary means of understanding use practices.
Just correct me on this, but when I read risk assessments a lot, they really also, EPA looks crop by crop. I mean, they not so much, they don't completely put it in boxes, but they are narrowing, assessing, does chemical X have a problem in this crop? Because then they can hone the label to that crop. So they're not looking at, does chemical X have a problem overarching in all of the different uses we've allowed? It's more focused crop by crop or site.
Yes. Some of that, so, I mean, that is the main focus because the labels are site specific and often the site is a crop. But they do look at general patterns of use when it at some level. When they do, increasingly, in an attempt to comply with the Endangered Species Act, They have to look for endangered species. They have to evaluate use based on critical habitat, which for a number of Salmonid species is the, you know, the entire Willamette Valley is critical habitat. So they need to make some, have some understanding of use, you know, across the Willamette Valley with regards to complying with the Endangered Species Act. But that's an evolving process and has not been settled, as you know. And how FIFRA and how pesticides are regulated under FIFRA and how they comply with the Endangered Species Act or the Clean Water Act or any other acts outside of FIFRA is still in process and hasn't been decided exactly how that's going to, how the registration process under FIFRA is going to comply with the requirements of the Endangered Species Act.
And the basic being that the threshold of acceptance of risk under Endangered Species Act is much more cautious than under FIFRA. So they won't, because it's an imperiled species, they will accept less risk compared to FIFRA.
Well, you know,
no?
There's those same sentences in the Endangered Species Act about harm that are very similar to that sentence in the FIFRA that says unreasonable risks to human health and the environment, which has a quasi-risk benefit balancing component to it, which doesn't exist in the same way or at all in the ESA.
Any other questions for Jeff before Rose starts?
See if I can phrase this correctly. There seems to be a lot of reliance on that, using, reading the label and using things correctly. Does anybody actually study whether labels are used correctly and followed and how well that's done?
Not that I know of. Anybody in the industry want to comment on that? Scott?
I don't even know how you would do that.
I don't either.
And it's got to be, I mean, if you're, like the folks that you represent are going to be much more aware of a label than a homeowner. I've seen studies on homeowners where they get their information about what to use. There was a study done in Tualatin.
Let me try it a different way.
Okay.
A lot of, somebody talked about reporting, the importance of reporting incidents,
mm-hmm.
but we had a discussion here last week about people being reluctant to report that they're in, say maybe they're in the ag community, and yet, and then people in their backyards may not even have a clue how to report anything or even think to or know that they've done it. So how good is that system of reporting and collecting data?
So within EPA, the Office of Pesticide Programs, within EPA, there's the Office of Compliance and Enforcement. Often with regulations, there's some sort of compliance enforcement component. And so under FIFRA, there's Office of Compliance and Enforcement. There are dollars allocated to that program, and a significant portion of those dollars are passed through to the states. And I don't know if Rose is going to talk about that.
I was going to talk about certification and licensing, but we do have a cooperative agreement with EPA, and so we are the agency that conducts the investigations. If there's an allegation of misuse, we do inspections of pesticide dealers. You know, we don't have a mechanism of assessing if your average grower understands the pesticide label. Often when we have a misuse investigation, we realize that that is the case, that there was a misunderstanding of the pesticide label, or sometimes, and I think this was the situation in Wilsonville, where the pesticide label is inadequate. And then we provide feedback to EPA about that. If there is a misuse which results in a negative effect to pollinators or animals, then we do report that information to the registrant, and the registrant has to legally report that back to EPA. But because we're in frequent contact with EPA, we also do the reporting with EPA. So there is a mechanism back, and I know that George brought up that people were afraid to report bee kill incidents, but, you know, again, I mentioned that last time as far as that kind of puts us at a little disadvantage of not being able to identify what the problems are so we could figure out, you know, maybe there's not an appropriate use or maybe we need to do more education and which one do we need to do?
Big problem.
So in the last year, you know, there's the recertification process that for restricted use products that where applicators need to be licensed and they need to either take the test over or
you're going to talk about that.
Well, part of the recertification process is folks like me go out and give presentations to applicators to maintain their license. And over the last year, I've probably given 8 or 10 presentations to applicators on pollinators. So this was my choice to do this because it's an important thing to be doing now, but it's not specifically written into any regulations or any requirement of what topics are covered in the recertification process. They have to meet certain criteria. So I'm also heavily involved in salmon issues. So do I make the decision to talk about pollinators or to talk about salmon? But there's no specific requirement right now for recertification to address specific topics.
We have two more questions, Jeff and then George.
Data gap assessment, I think, is an important one for us to discuss here. I mean, to try to narrow that chasm.
Yes.
You know, not just searching for the narrative that I would want, but to look at all the science. That the question that I have for you, it was remarkable to me that every 20 years was the cycle. It's like painting a bridge. Once you start with a chemical class, once you get through a certain number, you have to start over in order to do review. And I saw that moving from 20 years to 15, which I understand. But in your opinion, do you feel that how that assessment is formulated? Because I went back to your problem formulation component. So in my mind, I asked, did they do it right? What's the general process for review? What happens when there are spikes in an incident? I asked that question out loud because we're focusing a lot on the neonicotinoid issue, but is there a broader issue that we need to be addressing?
Well,
I think pesticide is one contributing factor, but when we look at nutrition for honeybees, all the other factors, and then kind of the education needs and research gaps that may just, you know, you don't want all the research to go for pesticide, you want it to go for the other elements as well that may be contributors. So I'm just curious about, in your opinion, when they go through this process, do you have faith in its rigor?
FIFRA was passed in 1970. It's been amended over the years in various ways. But the basic regulations that come out of FIFRA are pretty old. The re-registration process is new. There are areas where I think that the agency's hands are a little tied based on their requirements to carry out the regulations. And so there's that Congress should be doing something, but they're not.
That could be on anything.
And that could be for anything. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think it could be done better, but I also understand within the federal government and within this agency that there are real tangible, you know, impediments that are outside of what the scientists really want to do.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Because it spans 20 years, it also spans administrations and whims. So
all of it.
My question to you is, do you think that the process that they go through in order to get through to the end point has enough scientific rigor that you have faith in it?
I think in general it's very rigorous. But that's also tempered with all of the constraints that go along with implementing a federal law. That's what I'm getting. Okay. And as a scientist who's outside of that process, I'm happy I'm not one of the scientists inside the process because it's frustrating. It would be frustrating to me knowing that there are built-in constraints in setting up regulations and implementing a federal law. Now, the scientists within EPA, I think, are incredibly clever in how they move their science forward inside of this framework that probably needs to be changed by Congress, but isn't going to be. So, and there's going to be a couple of them speaking in San Francisco next week that I want to listen to see the next clever idea they came up with of how they make progress as scientists inside this framework that probably needs to be changed. The other side of it is that you guys in the industry, at that front line of pesticide use, part of my job is to know where the constraints are and know where the little data gaps are and help you from a business perspective make the right decisions about the practices, about your practices. And right now I'm heavily involved in water quality issues in this area. But pollinators is on the rise, and I think that I know Ramesh as a researcher is heavily involved too in this area. So I think in the future, there's probably more of this may have to be, initiated locally. Knowing that the framework meets certain requirements, knowing that there may be some data gaps that currently aren't being covered in that 15-year period. And there may be some opportunities for the industry to be more knowledgeable or more informed on that front line of how they could meet their production and environmental protection goals, given the current situation. So I'm making a plug, I guess, for OSU Extension. Yeah.
Okay, George.
I caught that. So two quick questions. First one is, who determines whether a pesticide is for restricted use or general use?
EPA does.
Okay.
And
for California?
Some states can be more restrictive. So, yeah, California is more restrictive than in some ways.
So states have some latitude, but yes. It's basically determined at EPA. All right, so how do you see new pesticides with novel modes of activity, say antifeedants, growth regulators, insect growth regulators, that have, where clearly the LD50 Tier 1 is totally inappropriate as a measure of toxicity or effect on an insect. How do you see that being resolved at this point? Because they're listed as safe for application on bees, but they clearly have an effect.
So EPA would have to make that decision. The Office of Pesticide Programs would have to make a decision to move a current pesticide that's not restricted to use to a restricted use category. The states have some latitude.
And EPA has done that. When additional data come in, they will change it from a general use to a restricted use pesticide.
The states under special cases can have their own restrictions.
Yes. For example, the state of Washington has certain 2,4-D formulations that are restricted use to ensure that people are trained and educated and licensed to apply them. I know Representative Reardon had mentioned a grape meeting that happened earlier.
But restricted use means, you have to be licensed to buy them, and to maintain your license, you usually take recertification credits. But there's no requirement now that those recertification credits include information on pollinators.
So
it's not. It can be on other subjects. They just
is
have
it
to
true
take
that the neonicotinoid group is general use, not restricted use.
What's the status?
They're general.
Yeah, they're general. Yeah.
95%. I think there's a little over 300 in the state, and 290 or so are general use.
So if EPA wanted to make a major change like that, they would make a proposal to put them on the restricted use. They'd probably go to the science advisory panel. There would be a long process. They would probably go to the dialogue committee. They've got a public dialogue committee. It would go to SAFIRAG, the state federal issues group. There would be a long, long process, many years probably, to move these products to restricted use.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. And we'll go ahead with Rose Kachadurian from ODA. So we are not taking a break, but feel free to sneak out if you like. Representative Reardon is out for a minute, so you guys can go as well.
We can talk about him now?
Yeah,
we
can.
I'm going to try to run through this because we're probably behind. I'm going to be discussing how does a person become licensed, how they maintain their license, a little bit about exams, who needs to be licensed and who does not need to be licensed, since this was something that's been brought up a couple of times, different licensing type, and some information regarding fees, because people were talking about budget items last time. I incorporated that, and I also incorporated some information about our registration fees versus Minnesota, because somebody had a question about that too. So to become licensed, initially licensed, there are certain steps, and the first step would be to become certified, and you become certified by passing exams. Usually, let's say somebody wants to be a commercial pesticide applicator, they would take the laws and safety exam in what we call category exams, and that might be, let's say they intend to use insecticides or fungicides on an agricultural crop, then they would take ag insecticide, fungicide. They would also have to work for a pesticide operator or own the company themselves and be a sole proprietor. Then they have to meet the licensing requirement, and that's basically completing the paperwork and paying a necessary fee. So we have many different types of exams. I won't go through all of these, but you can see that each one of these are separate exams. That first one, laws and safety, is a base exam. Then if somebody wants to apply pesticides commercially or as a public applicator in an agricultural environment, there are five category exams. An example I mentioned was an insecticide, a fungicide.
They have to pass all of them or just a some of them?
Whatever you want to make an application in. So let's say you want to make an application in only forestry. That's the only thing you want to do. Then you would just take laws and safety and pass forestry.
But if you were doing agriculture, would you have to take all five of the category exams?
Depending on what types of pesticides you wanted to apply. If you wanted to be able to apply herbicides also, then you would need to take the ag herbicide exam. If you wanted to take rodenticides, then you take the ag rodenticide exam. And that's one of, these are the types of things that we checked if we're doing a use or a misuse investigation to see if the individuals are properly licensed.
Rose, I have a question.
Yes.
How do they prepare for these exams? Do they have a curriculum where they can go and read some things, or?
We have required study material. There are some states that have a requirement that you take a class before you even take the exam. This state does not have that requirement. You know, Jeff was talking about FIFRA being old. Well, a lot of our laws are older, from 1973. And so we do not have that requirement that they sit and take an exam, but we do have required study material. There are some pre-licensing classes that are offered, and people voluntarily take those rather than that being something that's mandated.
Just to clarify, this license is only required to use restricted chemicals?
I'm going to go through when it's required and when a license is not required. So I'll go, I've got a bunch of slides on that. So we are amending and have amended some of our exams to include additional pollinator protection information. That would include the private applicator exam. That's basically something that's used by farmers or somebody who owns forestry property. We're in the process of amending the ag insecticide fungicide exam and also the ornamental insecticide fungicide exam. Most of our incidents that we've had with linden trees, people have had this license type, and so that was something that was a pretty high priority for us to amend. And I have to thank OSU for putting out a great publication that we've mandated as study material for those exams. So
can I just ask the timeline when that the new testing requirements will be in the tests?
Well, we have at least one exam, and actually Linda White is the person who actually helps write these exams, and so Linda, maybe you can provide that information.
In general or
I just mean the new pollinator information being added to the, it looked like three tests. What's the timeline for having that content added to the tests?
The study materials have been listed and have been for 6 or 8 months already as study material. And the exams, one will probably be fully amended within a month.
Okay.
Another one will probably take us another 36 months.
Private.
Yeah, that's a little, that one we have to decide how we're amending it, so I would say somewhere between also 3 to 6 months on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
So these exams, there are 100 questions, and if you can imagine, you know, we've taken out a lot of information to put the pollinator questions in there, and so we're looking at all kinds of issues, you know, drift, Jeff mentioned salmon issues. I mean, water quality issues are right up there. So we've got a lot of different things going on. So if somebody is going to keep their license, maintain their license, then what they need to do is they need to maintain their certification by earning the required number of certification credits, and I'll talk about that, and then pay the licensing fee. So the certification credits required for a 5-year period, if you're a commercial or a public applicator, then you would need to earn 40 credits within that 5-year period. If you are a private applicator, again, that's your farmer, then you would need to earn 16 credit hours within that 5-year period, and 4 of them must be core. And I'll go through what core is. So Jeff mentioned as far as types of classes which would qualify for recertification credits. And it's true, we don't have it mandated. Most states don't have it mandated as far as what somebody must, what types of education somebody must receive. It's kind of, the reason they don't have it is it's a nightmare to try to keep track. And a lot of times somebody will give a 40-minute presentation and they'll maybe talk 15 minutes about pollinators and like, how do you keep track of all of that? And so it turns out just to not be a very feasible thing. But the types of things that qualify for recertification credits would be basically information about the pesticide labels, calibration, how to comprehend them, how pesticides might affect the environment, drift prevention, laws, and also preventing pesticide exposure to pollinators and endangered species. And this is, again, another huge issue for the state to protect salmonids. So I mentioned core credits. These are required by private applicators, and then another category that I'll talk about, which is a trainee category called apprentice. But certain things qualify for core, and one of them would be integrated pest management. We do consider pollinator protection under integrated pest management. So if somebody were to give a presentation on pollinator protection, we would give that core credit. And those are highly coveted credits. Again, label comprehension, how to do the math, that's so critical. Drift, laws, pesticide, and then also information about personal protective equipment. So who needs to be licensed? Basically, people who purchase restricted use pesticides or supervise the use of restricted use pesticides. This is an example of a pesticide label, and it will say at the very top whether it is restricted use. This particular product is restricted use because of acute oral, dermal, and inhalation toxicity. And so the EPA, and certainly we do, want to ensure that that user is very well informed.
Okay, so
yes.
Is this a federal rule, or is this determined by state rule, or by
the feds,
legislature?
Actually, the federal government
because we have all the states basically have to develop these exams and have a licensing program. And so all 50 states have that type of situation, or else we would not be able to sell these. The federal government wouldn't even allow these sales into our state unless we had an approved program.
But then the opposite. I'm concerned about the general use ones that have been we've been discussing, but you wouldn't have to have a license to apply them. So is it a decision of the state or the Department of Agriculture to include people who apply those materials to have a permit or a license? Or is that a cannot be done because it's only the purveyor of
federal? So this isn't anybody's choice. I mean, the federal government has mandated this, and then we have that reflected in state law. So that there's no choice at this point that the person who's making this application of this product has to be licensed. If a state should choose to make a product on its own restricted use, and states do this, they'll say, well, all strychnine is restricted use or something else is restricted use. Then if the states have that legislative ability, and usually if there are documented incidents, then they can go in that direction.
That's a legislative action, or is it Department of Agriculture rulemaking?
Right. What we do, we basically look at our law and what we can do with our law and how we can classify pesticides. And so if, you know, depending on what this task force wants to come up with as far as making something restricted or use or not, it's, yes.
I just think it's worth noting we had a bill that would have made some neonicotinoids restricted use last session. So we learned a lot about it. And one of the things we found out is that the Department of Ag would be expected to be sued by all of the license holders for all of those products. So they would have a pretty massive fiscal associated with making such a change. And I think, too, there was a general, we've never done this before, only California does this. But in statute, it says very clearly that we have the authority to add to, there would be no federal problem with us adding to the restricted use list. It would be the cost to the agency, the controversy of passing such legislation, et cetera. But it was, I mean, the idea was met with incredibly strong resistance, and here we are all today as a result of the compromise that came out. But certainly the conversation was just like almost a shut door, which is understandable. Everybody has their opinions. I'm just stating, I think, what was clear to anybody who was there.
I just thought George's question had a different angle, which was, can we have a broader set of people be licensed to make applications? And you're going to get into that not all general use products are, you sometimes need a license for general use products, which
yes,
is true, and I know
yes.
you're talking about. But I thought his question was not, can we restrict the use, but can we have people be licensed to apply some of these general use in a broader sense than what we have now, not just third party.
Well, under certain circumstances, they are licensed. And if they're
right.
making commercial applications, then they're already licensed to do that.
There
is a section in here, and I think I have a slide on it. We normally think of this for people who are using restricted use pesticides, but there's also a little section in there or products that are considered acutely toxic, and that's acutely toxic. And so we have not ever developed a list of what those products are to say, yes, we're going to also regulate those. So that's, I think, one. I think that the law is not written in a really clear way that would allow us to just say, yes, these, for some reason, these neonicotinoids or whatever the pesticide is, that we're going to make that restricted use. I think there was a little bit of a lack of clarity there.
I'm still unclear.
It's a, well, you'll probably be even more unclear when I go through all this, too, as far as who can apply it and who can't. It's actually a very complex, and it is a confusing topic. As far as who else needs to be licensed, somebody who's applying pesticides, including herbicides, to somebody else's property, they would need to be licensed. And this is regardless of whether it's restricted use or general use. And so if somebody was making an application of a neonicotinoid or any other pesticide to somebody else's property, then they would need to be licensed. If somebody was a public employee and they were using power equipment, they would need to be licensed. Somebody applying pesticides on school property that's fairly recent, they would need to be licensed. And also if you're providing advice on a restricted use pesticide, who does not need to be licensed. Somebody who's applying a general use pesticide on their property or property they lease, and I think this is maybe where you had a question, or somebody who's using a general use pesticide on property owned by an employer, they're working for that particular employer. Somebody who's providing advice on general use pesticides, and I think, Amay, you had something in one of your emails as far as providing pesticide advice.
I've heard that from other people, and I thought it an interesting idea. I don't know where it came from, honestly, but someone mentioned, yeah.
And so at this point, it is legal if somebody is just providing information on general use products. They can provide that information. There are currently no standards for those individuals. And also if somebody is making or performing structural pest inspections. Veterinarians who are applying product in the scope of their job, let's say they need to put on spot-on products, they can do this without a license. Landlords can also make applications. If you're an apartment maintenance person that's doing a very variety of jobs and you want to, let's say, apply an insecticide to a tree on the property of the apartment building, you don't need to be licensed. Management companies. So this is actually highly dependent on contracts. So let's say you're an apartment management company and you're in control of 10 apartment complexes in Salem and 20 in Portland, and you're doing everything from collecting the rent, you've got total control, you could make pesticide applications and be unlicensed on those properties.
General
and this,
use.
General use, that's
not
right. Not restricted use. General use. And we have had some cases with this. Somebody can't be, and this is why we actually have to look at the contract to see how much control they have over that property and whether they're illegally acting as a pesticide operator. So probably the most controversial area that we have and has been controversial for a long time as far as who does not need to be licensed is often something called a landscaper exception. We have something in our law, of course this is from 1973, and the intent of this was if you had a gardener who was there at your house on a regular basis, and let's say you had some problem on your rose bush, or you know, you had weeds growing in the cracks of your sidewalk, that landscaper could just make that incidental application. This is actually kind of morphed into something that people have a lot of concerns about. We have licensed applicators calling us up saying there's a maintenance company that is making applications to commercial properties. They're doing all these applications, and we feel like they should be licensed. And so we actually do have some enforcement history with this landscaper exemption. We've had stakeholder meetings that are very contentious and have never really gotten very far. And it all has to do with basically whose main or principal work or business is the maintenance of small or home lawns, shrubs, or gardens. And so theoretically, somebody could look at that and feel like they could make applications to the, you know, credit union, the fast food restaurant, all these different small lawns, and not be trained and not be licensed. And so this has been a controversy or area, and that's in our law.
But we're still talking about general use.
Yes. Again, this is general use. General use.
Quickly, could you give a couple, you gave specifics on, you know, landscapers, veterinarians, hotels. You also said employer, owning your employer's property. And I made assumptions to who that could be, and I was wondering if you could just give, instead, I want to hear from you who that really is. And some of our groups talk more than the rest.
Yeah. So if you are, let's say you're a farmer and you have a particular general use pesticide, that you could tell your employer, ask your employee to make that pesticide application. You wouldn't have to do it yourself, because you're doing it as an employee of that particular farmer. That situation can also occur with restricted use pesticides, but those really have to be supervised very carefully. That's part of the law. So we have the general use, and there's not the mandate that employee needs to be carefully supervised, but there is that mandate if the employee is an unlicensed employee is applying a restricted use pesticide.
But in the general use example, neither the farmer nor the employee need to be licensed.
Correct.
With restricted use, the farmer or whoever's supervising,
yeah,
whoever's
purchasing or supervising.
Or supervising. Okay. Yeah.
And what are the two parts, I guess? On the supervision part, is there some specific guideline over what supervision means? And then how is that enforced?
As far as guidelines, I remember even when I was a pesticide investigator, I remember stopping a gentleman making a pesticide application, and he thought he was applying an herbicide, he was applying an insecticide. And he had no way of contacting his employer. That turned into an ODA and OSHA investigation, because we referred that to OSHA. It was a highly toxic insecticide. They really have to be in contact. You know, you can have the farmer who is, let's say the farmer is working by the shed. He gives, let's say, I'll give example of a restricted use pesticide, zinc phosphide, to control moles and grass seed. He can talk to the crew, ensure that they have the proper personal protective equipment, go over the label requirements with that crew, send that crew out. He's working in the shed or she's working in the shed and can see the crew out there. If that crew has questions or concerns, that farmer is available for consultation.
So they don't have to teach him how to calibrate or anything first?
No, they have to go through the whole process with them as far as proper use, proper personal protective equipment, to go through all of that training.
That's
they have to do that not only as part for ODA, but they have to do that for Oregon OSHA, because Oregon OSHA has a part in this with the worker protection standards, because these are our workers. And so we work very closely with that particular agency.
And then the enforcement?
With their enforcement.
What's the enforcement?
Oh,
so
what's
OSHA
their
enforcement?
The enforcement
vehicle?
OSHA's enforcement can be quite stark, actually. I think a lot of growers are concerned, and I think they're personally doing a great job. They really do take enforcement action. If they find that the applicator, the grower, is not doing his job, then they will take enforcement action, and so will we. And the growers are aware of that.
So you guys do have a role in enforcement also?
Yeah,
no.
We enforce
okay.
this,
okay.
yeah.
Okay,
how do you happen upon
these situations to do the enforcement?
Well, we do use observations. We actually do, we have a cooperative agreement with the EPA, and we do ag use observations. And like I mentioned, I was just driving by, and you'll stop and you'll start talking to the people, find out what information they know. OSHA does unannounced inspections also, and so they will talk with the workers as far as what information have you been provided about the use of this pesticide, as far as not only that, you know, we're mostly concerned, well, we're concerned with a lot of issues at ODA, but we're concerned about calibration, you know, drift, pollinator protection, all of that. And where OSHA's investigation mostly focuses on hazard communication and personal protective equipment, and whether they have been educated, whether there's proper bathroom facilities, whether there's eyewash, that sort of thing.
I'm trying to be clear, and you may have already said this, but is it in somebody's job description and ODA to monitor or police for proper use?
Yes, we have pesticide investigators, and that is within their job description to police that.
I asked a similar question to Rep. Reardon of someone else at ODA, and the there was a distinction between how much time is spent. And they specifically said they don't really look into general use. They're looking at licensed applicators. So is there oversight other than responsive if it's not for licensed applicators?
Well, again, if we're, you know, admittedly we have more access to licensed applicators. We know where they are located. But again, we do some of these drive-by inspections. And with those types of inspections, we do not know if they are licensed or unlicensed.
I do drive-by inspections too, but
nobody pays attention.
Anyone doubts that?
Okay. So, as far as types of pests, yeah.
Well, just at some point, I'd love to get. You mentioned this odd thing I'd never heard of, where you need a license to apply products that are acutely toxic, but we don't have a list. I was wondering where in the ORS I would find that.
Hopefully we'll have a slide on that. Hopefully I will. And I can find it. I brought my book with me, so before we leave here. So we have a number of types of pesticide licenses. Commercial, again, that's for somebody who's making pesticide applications in somebody else's property. Public, that would be an example of an ODOT worker who's making herbicide applications along the road. We have pesticide operator. This is the person who employs applicators. We have a pesticide consultant. Maybe this is where the highly toxic is. So this pesticide consultant only needs to be licensed if they are providing advice, again, on the restricted use pesticide or highly toxic pesticides. And we do not have that list. And then also dealers, and those are only dealers that sell restricted use pesticides. And so if you have a dealership that is just opted out of selling restricted use pesticides, then we would not know their location. But most farm locations sell some restricted use pesticides, and they are licensed.
So why isn't, is it, I hope I have the nomenclature right, tier one pesticides, ones which are listed as being highly toxic? I mean, you use the same exact words. Isn't that your list?
We don't have an official list. We would have to have this, we would have to actually have something, and probably in rule, we would have to go to rulemaking to develop such a list.
But they could adopt that if they wanted to. That could be a proposal.
We could definitely have that conversation as far as what constitutes.
Is that problematical? I mean, or
what would constitute a highly toxic pesticide? I think we'd have conversations with, Jeff and other people as far as where we're
what, where we're cutting off and what kinds of things we're looking at. Because if you're concerned mostly about sublethal effects for, let's say, pollinators, then you might not be capturing what you really need here.
But most of these neonicotinoids, if we're talking about that, that's what brought us here, are in fact listed as highly toxic, because when they are used in topical applications, then they are highly toxic. So, yes, they do have sublethal issues which are yet to be, categorized properly, but still they are listed as highly toxic.
So if the task force wants to make a recommendation that ODA develop a highly toxic list of pesticides, then that's something that you can do.
Just to clear, I'm wondering if maybe Jeff or Rose, because I'm kind of gray here, but there's a difference between like a tier one, we're talking about product versus an active ingredient, and what's on a label is a warning or a caution. And I think that should be clarified, because products are going to have a different terminology on that than.
Well, a lot of the.
And I don't know how this would work.
Yeah, a lot of those signal words that you're seeing are signal words set up for human safety rather than the bee safety. So you could have something that is set up as caution on as far as a signal word, and then you look and see it's acutely toxic to, or highly acutely toxic to bees.
Okay.
So you may have danger poison on the label, and that has to do, the narrowest interpretation is the mixer loader handler. That's the risk to the mixer loader handler. But you might also have on the label highly toxic to bees because it met that requirement that I showed you earlier. Well, and those are two different, and what Rose has there is highly toxic pesticides, and that's a much, much broader category than that.
And I'm guessing the neonics, when it comes to human health, they probably wouldn't be considered highly toxic under that categorization.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is a very, very broad.
Yeah, it is very. It is very.
And probably difficult to define.
Very broad. So there would have to be a lot of conversation as far as what you're thinking about.
We're going to see another task force.
I've been there, but
fish.
Oh no.
We're planning our next set of meetings.
The next task force.
Another task force.
Nice.
I've already mentioned.
You're invited.
I'm busy.
We won't leave you out, Jeff.
So I've already mentioned private pesticide applicators. Again, this is a person who supervises or uses any pesticide classified by the department as a restricted use or highly toxic pesticide. For purposes of producing agricultural commodities or forest crops or land owned leased by the person. So this would be, I'm pretty sure this is in our definitions, but I will look that up, as far as where that is.
And does that go back to 73?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay.
And I know other states have it written differently, where even a homeowner could be a private applicator, but we don't have that particular situation. That was actually one of the issues with some of somebody had brought that up as far as how does a home license become restricted, that we don't really have that kind of mechanism in our law at this point to have that. We also have two types of trainee licenses, and these we don't really consider them fully licensed, but one is immediately supervised, and that's where the person who hasn't taken an exam but still is right there with the person making an application. This allows them to legally do that type of application. And so this person would be working with a commercial or public applicator.
How long can you have that license?
Linda, do you remember how long you can have this?
It's a one-year license that can be renewed as needed.
So you could be a trainee for 35 years.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
It helps with people that maybe have language barriers as far as passing an exam. They could be really diligent, hard workers, and you can orally communicate to this worker how to make the application, and they do do the application correct, they follow all the safety standards, but because of some type of language barrier, they maybe can't pass.
Is the test only offered in English?
We have the private applicator in Spanish, and we have laws and safety in Spanish, but you still have to have a certain level of education to go through the math. We have actually quite a bit of math in some of these exams. So the other one is a pesticide apprentice, and that's one that the supervisor does not need to be on site. This person, though, has some pretty steep requirements. They must attend 8 hours of recertification credits for that year, and 4 of them need to be core courses. So since we were talking money last time, for a private applicator, our fees are actually pretty low, I think. For 5 years, a private applicator can have a license for $25. For commercial and public applicators, there's a $50 base fee, and then there are some category fees, some small category fees. For somebody who's a pesticide consultant, that's $40. Pesticide dealer, and these are all annual. The only one that was good for 5 years was private, that's your farmer, the forester. Dealer, $75, and then an operator, the $90 is the base fee. And operator is basically a company. So I'm almost done. This is probably my last slide. So because, again, people brought up money. ODA, we charge $160 per product for registration. So now I'm going to jump to registrations. We charge $160 per product for registration, although $250 is allowed by statute. There has been some conversation as far as raising that $160 because we're actually pretty inexpensive, and forming something similar to what our fertilizer group has. With fertilizers, when they register a product, a certain percentage of that or a certain amount is actually set aside for research. And so there has been some discussion, and you know, it's up to you as far as a task force what you come up with, but you know, there has been discussion about ODA doing that, raising our pesticide registration fees and using some of that money for research, whether it's research and in even education. So if let's say master gardeners wanted to work with homeowners and they needed travel money or money to produce educational materials, that they could apply for a grant from ODA, pay for by pesticide registration fees, and that could pay for that. Or if a researcher at OSU needed to conduct some studies because of some specific issues we were having in Oregon, then that money would be available. Currently, we don't have a mechanism to have a research fund in pesticides like we do in fertilizers. So just as a comparison, since we were talking about Minnesota, Minnesota has a $350 base fee, plus at the same time they're charged a $50 waste pesticide program surcharge. So that's basically, you probably hear about these events that we have where we'll pick up old pesticides, but we're always kind of scrambling for money to do that. Well, Minnesota has actually put something onto the registration fee. These are just wildly popular by growers and other people because they can get rid of product they don't use anymore that might be leaking, that they just don't want anymore. And so they have a way of funding those products, which we don't. And
Rose?
Yes.
But some of the money that went for that just after this last legislative session is coming from the pesticide fees already.
The pesticide stewardship partnership, mm-hmm. that we're actually really grateful for that money, because this has been probably the first time we've had like kind of some secure money. But we don't know how long that is going to last. And so that's not something that, you know, we're guaranteed. But we already do have some pesticide events set up where we could pick up material. So that is, I think, extremely positive and really well received by the grower industry.
Well, I mean, is that the point you were going towards, is that the pesticide steward partnership exists and some of the recommendations that could come out of this?
I mean, there's that too, but no, it was just the idea that I didn't want the impression to be that there's not support for those types of things, because we worked really hard to get some dollars for both the PSPs and, as part of that package, getting some of those waste pesticide programs. And that's not the term we use here, but I can't think of it.
No, that was I think, really great work and to get that money. And so those have actually been all scheduled. But as far as having kind of this you know, mechanism to already kind of be in place, so this money is just consistently set aside to pick up all of those pesticides that the agricultural community and others don't want, we don't really have that mechanism. Because at least, as my, maybe you know, and maybe Representative Reardon can comment, whether that money is kind of guaranteed for a long period of time. I don't know.
Biennial budget.
But did the registration fee go up when we put that investment in, and what was it before last year?
There was money still within the program. So what it kind of did, it accelerated when the fees will need to be raised to keep the current program going. So, you know, the way they do it is they try to give some statutory flexibility within there, and so the program doesn't build up a huge pot of money in the meantime by going to the max, but as it needs to be raised to keep up with new costs, they're able to do that. So what this did was, there was enough money within the 160 to add this program into there now, but it means that the fees will have to be revisited sooner than they would have otherwise.
And the fees, the 250, is that recently put into statute that you could raise it to that, or is that old news?
It's been there for a while.
And it has fluctuated. Like with pesticide use reporting, there was, I think, $35 extra per product. Or,
and then when that went away.
And then it went back down again. So it has been higher.
Well, we actually didn't lower our
confirm that. Check that. I'm not, Scott gave me a perplexity.
We didn't lower our fees.
Oh, you didn't?
No,
you
just, we didn't.
Okay.
It was absorbed into the program.
Okay.
As we expanded outreach efforts.
Okay. Okay.
So the other question I have, Rose, is there... Did you use Minnesota because we were talking about Minnesota the other day, or
no? I used Minnesota because we were talking about how they're funding, and you. I think maybe it was you who said they have a different mechanism.
Yeah, they've got a trust fund.
Yeah, so they also have these gross sales, and this was kind of getting at another question that somebody asked, as far as what percentage of pesticides are homeowner use versus ag use. And so they charge a different annual amount for gross sales for non-ag and versus ag. And they register pretty much the same number of products that we do at ODA. And so what I was told by the department is that 4,000 of these little over 12,000 products actually go into the ag group. And so, but I wouldn't assume that all the non-ag is homeowner. There could be for other uses.
So, Rose, when we're talking about the gross fee that goes for non-ag paid by distributors and registrants, so if the distributor is selling it to a Home Depot, who then may sell it to ag and not ag, how does the distributor account for that when they're paying the fee?
Well, the distributor would have to, it sounds like what happens, at least there, is that the distributor keeps track of how much product they send into a particular state, and then just pays a certain amount. So I don't exactly know, this is just what they sent me in an email, so I don't know the details as far as how they calculate sales fee.
So they're maybe not tracking actual sales?
Well, probably sales to retailers, but not what a retailer is selling. Because then you're getting into a whole another ball of wax when you start going to individual retailers and trying to figure out exactly how much they're selling. I don't know, California has a mill tax. Do you know about California's mill tax?
Yeah.
Don't know about California's what again now?
Mill tax?
Yeah, but it's complicated.
Okay. I know we both just said we're like,
I just wanted to put this up here. It's okay. All right, that's all I have right there, and I only put that up there because it covered two different topics.
But Betsy, were you concerned that an ag product would get charged a sales fee, like a product would get charged and then it would have been charged again because it's an ag, like there'd be some sort of double? Because they do distinguish in products whether they're for ag or homeowner commercial. I mean, they do divide that out. Is that what your question was about?
Well, I just wondered because I imagine that some of the product that gets sold to the larger retailers goes for ag in some measure, and I wondered how, you know, if they track sales there or if it's such a minuscule amount that they just don't worry about it and they call that non-ag.
Right.
I just wondered how it...
Yeah.
It's like if you game the system. I mean, you can go to Costco and buy Roundup Pro, and right, that's pretty close to what farmers are going to be using
right
as a product on a lot of stuff.
But
too,
usually so at a retail store, it's more expensive.
Actually, you know, I forgot something. How they're defining non-ag versus ag is if it has worker protection standards on the label, then that goes into the ag category.
So it's a barcode. So
that's how okay they define.
Yeah. Okay. Which makes it easy.
So based on all of that, could we get a rough notion of how much product goes to home folks versus commercial,
you know, agricultural? They said that they could not calculate that because so many pesticides that are very easily calculate that because so many pesticides that are sold that are non-ag could be antimicrobials used by water coolant tower people or some other type of use. So they don't really have a good idea.
If I can back up a little bit, when Rose was asking about the mill tax in California, if it would be beneficial to the rest of the group, I can come up with a short paper that might explain it.
I've been wondering about it for years and have never been able to conquer it.
So would, in your opinion, obviously, if we did something like that, there'd be money that would be coming in, but there would also be oversight costs and administrative costs and stuff. Would this have to be subsidized?
Yeah, we can, yeah.
In order to keep the money free to be able to do something, or would it all be just eaten up by administration?
Well, it depends on which thing you're talking about. Right? If you're talking about raising our fees, we'd go to rulemaking, and if we exceeded 250, then we would have to go to the legislature. But as long as we'd go through rulemaking, and we'd have a stakeholder group, have discussions. We do that all the time anyway. As far as having a granting program, we developed one for the stewardship, the pesticide stewardship program. And that does take some effort, and it would take some time to go through grant applications. So there is that type of, there would be an FTE associated with that.
I was actually thinking of the sales
portion.
The sales fee, that portion, in order to administer that, would that require some cost?
I don't know. We'd have to look into it. I know our fertilizer program already does that sort of thing, so there would be some cost as far as labor costs, and then also costs to revise our computer system to get all of that going. So there would be at least a pretty much an initial cost for that. I'm not suggesting that we
do that. No, I understand,
that,
but the fertilizer model would at least give some indication.
I'm confused now.
So the fertilizer program, people call it the tonnage tax, but it's actually an inspection fee.
And so it would, they have that type of thing built into their system.
You know, if I was thinking of myself, if I was thinking from an industry perspective, I would think, okay, how much, what are my sales in Minnesota? What are my sales in Oregon? What, so, I mean, part of what I'm going to, I'm willing to pay for to register my product is going to be linked with how much money I can make in that state. And so there's going to be states where you can charge a higher fee because it's, there's more demand. With this sales piece, it sounds like it's more by how much you sell. So in that sense, there's the benefit, even though we don't have, is that correct? I mean, because if you have a flat rate, but you're not selling much of a product, you might not want to register that state in that state anymore.
But it sounds like our state is such a low registration that it's not going to be a terribly huge impact.
I agree.
Sorry.
I agree.
I'm going to channel a legislator for a moment. If it sounds like a sales tax, people are going to be concerned about it. Meanwhile, though, we have a fee that is $33 below the average fee according to CISPA, which is, I'm sure, a resource that folks around the table can respect that are on the business side of things, I guess, whatever. The average is $193 per product, and our fee is $160. So just to raise the point that, like, you could say, oh, $250, right? Ooh, la la, right? And that would raise over $1 million. But by the same token, you could just bring us to the average, and you'd wind up with about $400,000 that could go towards some of the things that we've all talked about having a general interest in around education and outreach. So I'm just going to throw that out there so that it appears somewhere in the lexicon of our conversation as just something interesting to know. I just sat here and did the math and found that average cost, and I'm sure that folks would be very uncomfortable with even raising it, but I just wanted to point out that even just raising it to the average could be a robust without having to set up any new infrastructure, a sales system that would be totally new, et cetera. So
the only thing I would caution is that each state is very, very different on how they do the assessments and packaging them together and all of that. And so it's hard to compare a lot of times because pesticide programs are so different from state to state. That being said, I think that it's not out of the question to look at that as a source of money for an appropriate program. But of course, it's going to have to be tied really, really tight to what we're doing, and a strong case is going to have to be made about why pesticide fee should be used for whatever that might be.
Right. Yeah, I totally get that. I just wanted to point out that we are below the average. Here's what the average is per product according to CISPA. And it's a page about defeating unreasonable increases, by the way, that includes sort of their thoughts on what might be appropriate. And I feel like we could maybe get it something that would be appropriate according to at least their talking points here, but we'd obviously need to talk amongst ourselves and stakeholders and such. But just an interesting thought that we see what Minnesota's doing with a huge, robust system of fees that we, I think, politically would be pretty hard-pressed to have happen here. So maybe just thinking about the just smaller... I know, my job's probably to think big, right, and demand like a new sales tax and a huge, robust program, but I can't help but be political.
It's sales tax? What?
Yeah. Like anything that looks or feels like
that's
a sales
regressive.
Tax. Yeah. Believe me, we've had folks working on a very modest fee on bird seed to fund wildlife programs, and it's been like just shot down again and again because it feels like a sales tax. So
we only have 10 more minutes, so if you don't have any specific questions based on our presentation, then probably we can ask her some questions that we have here on the work plan, which are very specific, I guess, for ODA, and probably Rose is the only one that can answer here. If you look at that work plan thing, there are some questions, right, for the pesticide applicator training, certification, licensing. There are at least 6 or 7 that Beth has listed there. So if anyone has very specific questions on there, we can ask her. Or
sorry, I fell off.
Well, I'm just trying to. I'm concerned about the limited amount of time that we have, or the tasks that are on. And when we kind of think we have sort of a sense of where we're going, are the tasks on here necessarily the right task, in light of, you know, other topics that, that people have expressed an interest in. So are we still on the right task?
And we haven't even addressed the first item on the agenda or the way Beth broke it down, which is other states, countries, pesticide laws. We were going to look at the memorandum from the White House and EPA, and that was on for today.
You want to spend some time next meeting, like first 30 minutes on that, and then maybe we can switch to a different topic?
Yeah,
I know, unfortunately, we have only a few meetings, and there are too many things to discuss.
Can I just ask a question? Like, we're having these really short meetings, which is fine, but, like, I think about interim committee meetings and committee meetings, and, I mean, could we do a three-hour meeting and get a little bit more time together that way? Because I drive an hour just to get here. I think a lot of people do. So I just wanted to raise at least my openness to having a three-hour meeting instead of a two-and-a-half-hour meeting to see if we could be able to have our... Because clearly we like to talk. We either stop talking or have somebody who's, like, manning the clock and telling us no more questions, or we just need more time when we do meet.
We do 3 hours and 15 minutes and have a coffee break in the middle.
But just something I would raise. I mean, if I'm driving 2 hours anyway, I'd rather get an extra half hour at least in.
So the next meeting scheduled from 1 to 3:30, it's fine to make it longer if you would like.
When do they turn the lights out?
5.
Really?
Yeah, actually, they really like...
Oh, you have to bring up.
Yeah, you do. You can go 1 to 5. You can go 12:30 to 4:30. I'm here, so...
I'm open.
Should we go 12:30 to 4:30?
What day is that again?
Yeah, it's...
If we do have a longer meeting, those that need to be quarter to the meetings need to get going.
There are, you know, the other thing is if you're having trouble with the meters, there are some alternatives that you can buy a pass and things that would help with that. So just let me know if that's an issue.
Except that they're $15.
They're a lot. It's all right.
Yeah. But we can park here? Or?
Yeah.
And in the basement, you can get quarters.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So one to...
Well, what are the if you would need to put in enough... Well, as long as you park in an 8-hour meter... The deal is you just don't want to park at a 3-hour meter.
Yeah, over on Winter Street, they have a whole bunch of 10-hour ones right in front of like a church or
And half of the ones in front of the Capitol.
Yeah, so, a lot of them.
Well, if you're willing to walk a few more blocks, if you just go park by Macy's or down at, it's open. You can stay there all day for free.
There is a McDonald's next door here.
No, they took all the restrictions off of parking hours downtown somehow. So all you have to do is just park downtown and walk. I mean, I parked by the pita pit that's 2 blocks away last week and walked 10 minutes.
Hope you felt better when you got
here. I am waddling, so I'm very slow. You could probably make it in 7.
So everyone is okay for 5 o'clock meeting next one on August 18th?
I mean, it might be nice to do 4:30, just from a perspective of anybody who gets out of Salem. It's a lot better if you can get out before 5, as far as getting on to the way.
So 1 to 4:30? Yeah.
And then we could catch up on what we missed today.
Yeah.
So since we only have a little more time, suggestion on habitat and in particular state lands and stuff like that, I don't know if anybody has something already, if there's something that was in the works. There's some stuff they tried to get into the transportation bill that didn't make it. Pollinator Partnership may have some language. I really don't know, but I think if we came with something already and we could look at it and fool around with it a little bit, that would be, I think we can get consensus on something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Give direction to municipal and state entities.
I think there's something that could deal with the three components together. I mean, you know, thinking about disease, parasites, concerns, you know, when you're introduced, and then as well as forage and habitat, and also concerns with pesticides in that forage and habitat, or do we just want to move? I mean, is there a way to think of bills that are addressing all three of those issues together, because they are interconnected?
My perspective is that I think we're looking at pollinator health, not pesticide application.
Right, right.
So I think even if it's commending more research on the other two items and there's anything that's low-hanging fruit for the nutrition and the mite problems, mm-hmm. I would look to our beekeeper friends about what are some best practices that can help with that as a way to try to launch into an area of greater discovery. But I think it's incumbent upon us to address them all.
And I definitely want to, I didn't today with the conversation being about honeybees, and there's a lot of differences for honeybees and native bees, and a lot of our native bees are solitary. So that means there's a single female and she's in charge of all of the larvae. There's a lot of differences, and so I like that, and I think at that point we're definitely going to want to bring in knowledge about how to make those choices for native bees, not just honeybees. And it's a lot of overlap, so I think it'll work well, but there are some decision practices and decisions that will be different.
That would be my comment, is that somehow in language or we incorporate native and wild bees into the effort, because it isn't just honeybees, and there are other pollinators as well, but I think somehow if we can incorporate that, at least in language somehow, that it would be an important inclusion.
And growers will want that. There's a lot of research showing the value of our native bees, increasing the quality and the quantity of product. Blueberries is a great example. There's a reason. It's not just because they're cute and fuzzy. They're definitely part of the economic landscape. And they are cute and fuzzy.
That's my reason for being here.
Let's have a cute and fuzzy one on the cover. Can we all agree to that?
I think absolutely. We'll get you a good photo, I'm sure.
When Ramesh was talking about the first day that you did your presentation, and one of the things you talked about was how the lack of the decreasing diversity among bee populations was causing such a problem. And, I don't think that's a well-known fact out there. And so it does seem like if we could include some health measures to increase or try and increase the diversity or speak to that, it would be beneficial.
I think in the areas where we all uniformly agree with your initial kind of assessment, you put that in a more proactive stance. So the diversity of the bee population, the nutrition, the varroa mite, which is downright scary.
So Rose, are you available next meeting? Because we still have questions for you, but
okay.
The time is up, so we'll grill you again on,
okay.
on the 18th. Then. Yeah, we'll start with you, and then we'll proceed to other things, which Amai was...
I'm going to be on the phone, so it'll
you'll
it
be
could
on the
be
phone.
A shorter meeting anyway. Because be here.
We'll all be on the phone as well.
You're the one
shaking.
Might be real short.
So everybody, come pass the stuff. They're not going to like. It's really hard to hear on the phone.
So we still have a minute. Any last questions or any confusion? So the next meeting is until 4:30, and get prepared for that. We can still exchange emails. There's no restriction on any of those. So if you think there is something we're missing, we can still.
So I want you all to know that I'm being interviewed by OPB on the driver's card bill, but they also mentioned that they wanted to talk about the pollinator task force.
What was the first one?
The driver's card.
Oh, great.
Bill, and so.
Be positive.
No, yeah. I just want to. I didn't want you to hear something on OPB and. In case they bring that up. My sense is to talk about our desire to come and give a good recommendation and that how complicated kind of the broader issues are. But I just wanted you to know that I'm talking to them about the driver's card, but she also tagged on, and see her on the Pollinator Health Task Force. We might bring that up too.
I talked to her about it this morning.
I was going to say Cassandra Prophet.
Right.
Yeah. I also, she called me and basically I said, we're under discussions. I don't think we've made any recommendations because she asked me specifically about the 20,000 for bees, and I said, no, we've talked about it. And so I think
okay. Well, it's good to know that I'm third on the run.
Cool.
It's cool.
Well, shoot, I haven't even been called. So.
Yeah.
Nothing else, Superintendent? Do you have something else to say?
She's looking to find out where we disagree. I mean, the question she asked wanted to...
So she's looking for the heat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, she's a reporter, right?
Everybody wants to talk.
Yeah, I mean, she's a reporter, right?
Everybody wants to talk. Okay.